From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, predictions about the digital revolution, what's real and what's merely hype. We talked to Paul Duguid, co-author of The Social Life of Information. Duguid says many of the tools, jobs, and organizations that were said to be destined for extinction are alive and well and likely to stay that way. Duguid is a consultant at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Also, the exquisite pleasures of urban decay. We meet Ben Catcher, creator of the comic strip Julius Knipple, Real Estate Photographer. Catcher was recently named a MacArthur Fellow. His new book is called The Beauty Supply District. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. President Clinton today played host to Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. It was the first day of their Mideast summit at Camp David. The White House says the three men met together for half an hour before separate two-way meetings between the president and the Mideast leaders this evening. White House spokesman Joe Lockhart described the discussions as serious and said they were held in a good atmosphere. The founder of the Children's Scholarship Fund and one of America's richest men today called for an end to what he calls the U.S. government's monopoly of public education. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Ted Forsman, a Wall Street billionaire better known for leveraged buyouts, is launching a $20 million TV ad campaign that he says will remind people that too many children are still trapped in bad public schools. Forsman wants parents to demand the right to choose the school they want their kids to attend, which would include homeschooling, private and parochial schools, or publicly funded charter schools. Forsman, though, insists this is not a campaign for tuition vouchers.
Vouchers, as they've been defined politically, are kind of a narrow concept. It's Republicans on one side, Democrats on the other.
Forsman, a Republican, says he'd also like to see Vice President Al Gore and Texas Governor George W. Bush hold a debate on education, a debate he'd like to sponsor sometime this fall. I'm Claudio Sanchez, NPR News, Washington.
Russian President Vladimir Putin seems to be making good on his promise to end privileges for the country's business elite. Police raided energy and media giants today, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
One of the targets of a police raid was media mogul Vladimir Guzinski, who spent several days in jail last month and now faces fraud charges. Security officials carted away financial documents from the headquarters of his Media Moss group and searched the independent NTV television, which is part of his influential empire. In other action, tax police launched a criminal investigation against the head of Lukoil, Russia's biggest oil producer, accusing him of falsifying tax refunds. Another one of the so-called oligarchs, Vladimir Putanin, is meantime facing questions about his purchase in the mid-90s of the metal giant Norilsk Nickel. The prosecutor's office said he underpaid by $140 million in the privatization deal and should pay up now if he is to avoid criminal charges. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Moscow.
The lead attorney at the tobacco trial in Florida says a multi-billion-dollar award would be a death warrant for the five tobacco companies being sued. The jury listened to closing arguments today before deciding how much in punitive damages sick Florida smokers should get. Jurors already awarded more than $12 million in compensatory damages. The case is the first class-action tobacco lawsuit ever to reach trial. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Averages ended up 80 points to close at 10,727. The Nasdaq was down 24 at 3956. This is NPR News. The University of North Carolina has named a new head basketball coach, Matt Doherty. Doherty is currently the coach at Notre Dame and will be announced as the new Tar Heel leader later this evening. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports from Raleigh.
Doherty becomes only the third head coach the Tar Heels have had in the last 40 years. He takes over from Bill Guthridge, who retired last month after three seasons guiding one of the nation's most successful basketball programs. Before Guthridge, the legendary Dean Smith served as head coach for 36 years. Doherty played for Smith on UNC's national championship team in 1982 and was one of several former Tar Heel players interviewed for the head coach position. Prior to Doherty's hiring, UNC also considered Kansas coach Roy Williams, who turned down the job, and two NBA coaches, Larry Brown of the 76ers and George Karl of the Bucks, who both removed their names from consideration yesterday. Doherty has coached one season at Notre Dame, where he led the Fighting Irish to the NIT Finals. Adam Hochberg, NPR News, Raleigh, North Carolina.
Metallica's drummer says Napster hijacked the group's music. Lars Ulrich told the Senate Judiciary Committee today that the free giveaway of music on the web is the same as stealing music from a store. Metallica is suing Napster for copyright infringement and racketeering, following internet users for allowing them to download music for free. Federal investigators today said cruise ship companies should drop their opposition to installing individual smoke detectors in crew and passenger quarters. The International Council of Cruise Lines has opposed the proposal, claiming that individual smoke detectors could produce numerous false alarms, and that could result in mass panic aboard ship. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've heard many predictions in the past few years about how the new information technologies will change our lives. The book will become obsolete. The university campus will be replaced by courses on the internet, and more than half of American workers will work out of their homes. My guest, Paul Duguid, is the co-author of the new book, The Social Life of Information, which attempts to separate the cyber hype from reality. Duguid is a historian who is a consultant at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, which his co-author, John Seely Brown, directs. Their book expands on a series of essays they wrote about how the design of new technology affects how people learn and work. Duguid disagrees with people who predict the book will soon become obsolete.
Well, I think one of the things to get clear first is that, you know, the book has for a long time held together a great many different sorts of objects. It's held together railway timetables or airplane timetables or car parts catalogs. And there is no doubt in my mind that if I needed to consult the car parts catalog or have someone do it for me, I'd much prefer them to do it using a CD-ROM or an online database than flog back and forth through a book. So in some sense, what seems to be happening is some of the things that are really not very well adapted for pages bound together between covers have now left the book, and that seems to be well worth it for everybody. But in some ways, the way a book contains within a certain length what the author has to get across, and as you read it, barely noticeably, you know, your left thumb and finger are getting closer together, telling you that the story is winding up without any conscious interruption to the way you're reading. Or the way, conversely, the short story will suddenly come to an end, clunk, and you won't have realized that it's winding up. Are things that authors use in order to get their story across, to convey their meaning, to evoke certain circumstances. And those are the sort of subtle aspects of a book, I think, that it's very easy to miss or underestimate. Also, of course, as people like John Updike recently talked about, you know, books do furnish a room. If you have them on the walls of your house, people can somehow understand what you read, where you've come from. They're great ways of signaling our own intellectual background and learning. That doesn't quite work with a row of CD-ROMs. So there are a lot of subtle effects of books that I think will probably keep it in play for a long time.
It's been predicted that people won't have to go to the office anymore because we have so much office and information technology that we can use at home that can interconnect us to the other people that we work with. And I think it is true that many more people are working at home and many more people are working with colleagues who live in other states or other cities or other countries because they can interconnect through email and faxes and phones and so on. But you raise a lot of the problems that you have if you're working at home alone, technological problems even. What are some of the problems that you see?
Sure. Well, here I have to say I speak from the heart because I do most of my work at home alone. Mm-hmm. There are many reasons that I would never want to go back into an office life of 9 to 5 and that feeling of sort of trapped that your time is someone else's possession during the day. But I think that some of the talk that, you know, by now we would all be living in electronic cottages and some predictions that by the year 2000 downtowns would be dead have clearly not come true. And I think the reason for that, again, is that those making the predictions have underestimated what it is, on the one hand, that keep people together in offices, and on the other, that make work at home alone rather an isolating and difficult experience. And strangely, much of the technology that is meant to help us get from the congested office out into these wonderful electronic cottages seems to me in some ways to have been a good deal of the problem. A lot of us have been sent home with what I think of as industrial strength technology and assumed that alone we could somehow survive on that. And people who work in offices know that when a software upgrade comes through, it can be something like a dose of the flu, laying people out for months, for weeks on end. And of course, if you have to manage that alone without IT managers, et cetera, et cetera.
IT is information technology.
Without somebody who is an expert in managing that, but you're really trying to install new stuff on your own, following these wretchedly inadequate manuals and web pages, it can be enormously difficult. Very frustrating, and drive some people back to the office from whence they thought they'd fled for good.
I think with all the new technology, a lot of companies want to be sure that they're on the cutting edge, and they want to rearrange the corporation in a way that's congruent with all the new technology, that suits and reflects the new technology. And some companies end up making some big mistakes along the way, and you cite at least one of those in your new book. Talk about the hot desk.
Well, the hot desk was really this idea that not only did we not really need to work in offices, but if for some curious reason people would still have to come to a central place, they would no longer need to have their own particular workspace, their own particular wall on which they would pin up paintings or their children's drawings or their diary or whatever, that they could simply come in the morning and pick up a laptop and a cell phone and go off to a little cubicle on one side and do all their work there. And if you look at things from what we call the logic of technology, this seemed actually a wonderful idea. But the logic of humanity, which tends to work rather differently, undermined it. One of the things that they discovered in the office was that while people will often say that offices instantiate a certain sort of pecking order and the hierarchy is very heavily marked, when you pull away all restraints, the turf wars are even worse. So people would fight over the best places in the office. People would try to send in their assistants early in the morning to get the best hot desks, no doubt with the sun or nearest to the coffee. And there was every day a reformed turf war, which really made people very unhappy. And the notion that this would lead to an egalitarian office, I think, was very quickly undermined.
Now, where was this tried?
This was tried at Chiat Day, the great advertising agency that created much of the Apple Think Different advertising, and they clearly were thinking different in some interesting ways. But I think that they came unstuck and realized after 5 years that this wasn't the way the office was ready to work, and they had to go back to an older and more established form of office.
Let me get to another prediction that we've been hearing, which is the traditional university will be replaced by cyber universities, where you'll be connected to the information that you need or the teacher that you need online and through the internet.
This is one that has interested us a good deal. And in the book, we open with an example from a rather celebrated IBM advertisement of an elderly grandfather talking to his daughter in a vineyard in Italy. And it's a very elegant setup, and they have English subtitles as they talk in Italian, and he reveals to his daughter that he has just received his PhD from Indiana University, which is a very nice reversal. You would expect it to be the granddaughter who would announce this. And then he announces the reason he was able to do this was that the university had put its library online. And that struck us as extraordinary in its conception of what education is, what the university is, what changes will do. It seemed to say that really getting a PhD is simply a matter of having an access to a library. And perhaps in that there's the early idea that really getting information, getting an education is simply a matter of getting information, and that what teachers do is simply ship information to you, and we can probably do that better technologically. And anybody, I think, who sits and pauses for a little while about their education will realize that simply being informed was only a minor part of it. Becoming socialized, meeting your peers, learning from them, watching people who were perhaps not very articulate but expert in their fields carry out their job, the whole social world of schools and universities is suddenly cut out of the picture, and all you get is this thin stream of information. And it's easy but very misleading to believe that that's the core of education.
So I guess one of the points that you're making here is that there's a big difference in receiving information and actually learning, comprehending and having knowledge.
Yeah, I think there really is. The psychologist Jerome Bruemer, I think, makes a wonderful distinction between what he calls learning about and learning to be. And learning about is the way that we pick up bits of information here which sound interesting and we pass on and we can chat about, but we can't really do anything with. I can watch a program about penguins in Antarctica, as I did last night, but I'm never really likely to become an Antarctic bird fancier on the basis of that. But the other thing that Jerome Bruner says we do is we learn to be. That is, we acquire an identity. We become writers or scholars or radio interviewers or engineers. And that's a much more intense process which involves our entire identity, which brings in our whole personality, brings that to bear on what we're learning. And I think that's the sort of thing that genuine education starts to get at. And that's why it's very different from simply picking up bits of information here and there.
My guest is Paul Duguid, co-author of the new book, The Social Life of Information. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is historian Paul Duguid. He's the co-author of the new book, The Social Life of Information. One of the big controversies now surrounding information on the internet has to do with copyright. Mm-hmm. You know, should recording artists and songwriters be given royalties when somebody downloads their music? Should writers be given any kind of royalty if somebody reads something on the internet, downloads something that the writer has written? Some people feel, no, the great thing about the web is that it's democratizing information. We have a new technology, and that requires new ways of dealing with information sharing. And you know, the ideas of ownership of information are out of date now, and that's a good thing. And I'm wondering your thoughts about that as a historian studying this.
Well, historically, it has some interesting precedent in that in the 19th century, you may know, America refused to sign on to international copyright laws, which, for instance, made The Visit of Charles Dickens to America in 1842 a very tendentious occasion, because Dickens came along and said, here you are, you're praising me, you love my work, but you won't pay for it. It's pirated around the country. And at the same time, as new presses were being put up, as the way in which a newspaper could be put out very quickly and contain an entire book if they chose was emerging, people were making the argument that you hear again today, that the law of property law of intellectual property is immoral, that ideas should be free. I don't think they said information then, that there is no reason that anybody should be paid for what is, in a sense, God's knowledge. So there is a precedent for that, and I think it is one of the huge challenges we see today and is tending to push in a couple of different directions. One, I think, is it's tending to try to discover technologies that will control minutely our every interaction with information. They're now trying to create technologies that if I download pages over the web, they will allow me to read them once and then the page will dissolve. If I want to pass that page on to somebody else, I have to pay a second fee. If I want to make a copy of it, I have to pay a third fee. And those are changing from one end to regimes of extraordinary control. And those, I think, are pretty worrying. But at the other end, as someone who lives in part by writing myself, the idea that I can't make a living out of what I write, that it can simply be taken from me and passed around, is, among other things, going to stop me and people like me from writing. I'm not going to say that my writing would necessarily be a loss to society, but I think the general sense that that if nobody is going to be interested in protecting intellectual property, there will not be much interesting intellectual work done, which is the other side of the minute control, I think is equally worrying. And it's going to take quite a battle, not just a technological battle, to find a way between these two extreme positions.
Right, and what I was talking about too, though, is that the internet is not only freeing up information and democratizing it, but it's a store. It's a big store now.
Yeah, and more and more things that I think in the past were of necessity accessible and free are actually now being sold to us. I spoke to a friend of mine who wrote a wonderful book about San Francisco, Imperial San Francisco, not long ago, and he said that he thought he couldn't do the research that he did for that book, A History of San Francisco, that he couldn't do that research now because so many of the sources which were public access not long ago, particularly to photographs, now he would have to pay for every item. So there is a shift, in a sense, to commercialize a great deal of what we once thought was free. And that's happening a certain amount with libraries who are suddenly discovering that they can make money out of parts of their collection, and so free access is no longer being allowed. So yes, I think that behind those great claims of democratization, there are a lot of very savvy and rather unfortunate commercial moves being made.
One of the things I'm wondering about is if culture is going to become more fragmented, if we're going to be more separated from each other than before. And I guess what I'm thinking is this. Now that there's cable TV and so many different options on the internet, we're not all watching and listening to the same things like we once did. Culture keeps subdividing and subdividing, which is fine. It means that our special interests are getting better addressed than ever before. The only downside of it, I think, is that we used to have pop culture to hold us together. We'd watch the same TV shows and read a lot of the same books and see the same movies. I think people are still seeing the same movies because there aren't that many choices, in movie theaters. But the rest of culture is becoming so fragmented.
I think it is, and becoming particularly difficult to talk about. I mean, maybe one thing it does is it challenges some of the old generalities that we used to make about technology and about culture, and assume that people were all looking at these things together in the same way. And perhaps there already was something of a balkanization, even when everybody was reading very little more than the Bible several centuries ago. The different ways that they read the Bible, the different and wholly opposed groups that formed around it, maybe in some way prefigured the sort of balkanization that we're getting now. I think, as advertisers obviously tend to think, what this sort of fragmentation does is it puts an enormous premium on those things that can pull people together, on the occasional big movie, the big show, CBS and Survivors. Those things become more and more significant, not only financially for the advertisers, but I think in some ways more culturally significant. I think a little while ago some of us might never have thought of watching Survivors, but because it is such an extraordinarily significant program in pulling people together who have been fragmented, suddenly it takes on a much greater interest.
My guest is Paul Duguid, and he's the co-author of the new book, The Social Life of Information. As a historian, I imagine one of the things that you particularly enjoy is holding in your hands a document from another era, which you don't get to do if you're finding information on the internet and everything is contained on a screen.
Yeah, and for me, such documents can often tell you a great deal about how, in a sense, looking at information alone is a limiting process. To take an example, I was working in an archive in Portugal from the things I was looking at from roughly the time of the Revolutionary War, so 1770s, 1780s. And these boxes contained letters. They're about the size of a styrofoam cooler, and they will contain the entire year's intake of letters to a firm. And many of them have barely been disturbed for 100, 150, 200 years. And I, unfortunately, tend to suffer from asthma. So as I pick these things out, my eyes will run, my nose will run, and I will feel that the one thing I would really like to do is scan these documents, you know, put them on the web, and never have to deal with these layers of dust again. And one day I was sitting there reading these documents with a handkerchief around my face, looking like a bandit, trying to keep the dust out of my nose, when this man came in and sat down beside me and started to work on another box. And he picked them up, and he would pull out a letter, and he would put it, he wouldn't even read it, he'd put it under his nose and drag it from side to side and take an extraordinary deep sniff, which sent my sinuses into complete shock as I saw him doing this. And he carried on doing this for about 10 minutes, and once in a while he'd open a page and he'd make a small note, and then he'd fold it up and put it away again. And soon after, British resistance was overcome by intense curiosity, and I turned to him and I said, "Look, what on earth are you doing?" And it turned out that he was a medical historian, and he was tracing outbreaks of cholera in the 18th century. And when cholera broke out in a particular town, the authorities, as the mail went out, would sprinkle it with vinegar to disinfect it. And so now, 200 plus years later, by sniffing the letters, he would still get the faint trace of vinegar, and he would know how the disease had spread across the country. But what was interesting for me was that it wasn't simply that I now knew something about medical history, but it put a complete new interpretation on the content of those documents, which I thought could just be separated from the paper and the letter and the dust. Because if I opened a letter and it smelled a little of vinegar, I suddenly realized that somebody saying, you know, business is fine, send us your goods, our credit is nothing to worry about, probably was overstating a situation which was quite perilous. And so I began to read these letters in a new light, and suddenly the sense that all there was information in the writing and noise or interference from the paper itself came to seem a problematic distinction, which I think is one now as we try to transfer things from books onto the web, as we try to scan information and leave, as it were, this husk behind, start to seem to me much more problematic than I realized before.
So did you find any correspondences with vinegar?
Yes, several. And in fact, occasionally you would pick up a letter and it would look like a piece of Gruyere cheese. It would be holes almost completely because they'd over-vinegared it and almost everything had gone. But yes, no, you still do find that once in a while you'll open a letter and there is that sharp smell of vinegar and you read with an especial new interest.
Well, Paul Duguid, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Paul Duguid is the co-author of The Social Life of Information. He's a historian who is a consultant at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications. BEA.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, life in the cheap merchandise district. We talk with Ben Catcher, creator of the comic strip Julius Knipple Real Estate Photographer. Catcher was recently named a MacArthur Fellow, winning the so-called Genius Award. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ben Catcher, is the creator of the comic strip Julius Knipple Real Estate Photographer. The strip follows Knipple on his journey through the edges of New York City, through neighborhoods Catcher has renamed, like the Cheap Novelty District and the Cheap Merchandise District. Catcher has a new book called The Beauty Supply District. Last month, he won a so-called Genius Award, a MacArthur Fellowship of approximately $500,000. The MacArthur Foundation praised his work for conveying an ironic, compelling, and bittersweet nostalgia for the detritus of city life, for capturing the streets, small shops, and lunch counters of a remembered New York. A few years ago, Catcher teamed up with radio producer David Isay, who also won a MacArthur last month, to create short radio dramatizations of the Julius Knipple strips. Several of them ran on NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. Let's hear one before we meet Catcher. The announcer is played by Dick DeFreitas, Ben Catcher is the narrator, and Jerry Stiller is Julius Knipple. This will help describe the Cheap Merchandise District.
Ladies and gentlemen, let us stop for a moment in our mad flight and return once again to the city. Here in a low-rent office building on the edge of the Cheap Merchandise District, Julius Knipple, the real estate photographer, suffers on a daily basis the exquisite pleasures of urban decay. Pleasures bought at the expense of countless others who came before him. But we're not here to buy, we're just looking.
In the same way a doctor associates certain physical signs with the end of a human life, Mr. Knipple knows what to expect at the last stop on any subway line.
A trophy manufacturer. Movie theater converted into a business school. The offices of a wedding orchestra. A dietetic candy store. A bus driver's uniform supply store. An illegal franchise of a defunct fast food chain.
However, these last manifestations of private enterprise can linger on for a quarter of a century or longer.
A plastic slipcover showroom.
Now that you've heard about the Cheap Merchandise District, let's hear about the Beauty Supply District, which is the title of Ben Catcher's new book of comic strips.
Yeah, the Beauty Supply District is a commercial center of this imaginary city, where people deal in the business of aesthetics, I mean, in all its forms, from there's a symmetry shop, there's a proportion surveyor, there's a two-dimensional aluminum contour extruder. It's where people go to buy aesthetic advice and services.
Which shops do you think you could make use of?
Probably the
sort of a shop of narrative invention, or the forms of narrative invention, if I could sort of... I mean, within the strip, there's an artist who says this is the fantasy of many artists, that they wish they could sort of buy the solutions to a lot of their artistic problems, like most people can buy things. And this is my depiction of that place existing in the real world and sort of going out of business toward the end of the strip. It disappears.
Some people really have this desire to go to the new happening hotel with mm-hmm. the fabulous new furniture and the bar with all the happening people. Oh, you know, or the new restaurant that has the latest nouveau cuisine. Mm-hmm. Or the shopping mall that has the greatest new boutiques. You're really attracted to diners that have crusted food on the table left over from previous dinners. Where the whole room smells kind of like ketchup and runny mayonnaise. And you're interested in shops that sell, cheaply manufactured things from abroad. You're interested in kind of crack streets and old signs. Why is it, do you think, that that's what interests you, that that's what you're drawn to?
That's, I don't know, I'm interested. I think most businesses age fairly quickly. I mean, the newest development, the newest hotel, you know, within a week has a certain veneer of use. And I think in a city, that happens at a tremendous pace. If you're in a small town, things are painted over more frequently. The sort of traces of time are more easily effaced. In New York City, you can go to the newest development in Times Square, and it already looks like it's had it, and it's worn out, and people are ready to, you know, cash in their corporate interest and move on to the next thing. So I don't know. It's that feeling of wear that you get in a city. And that's just because of the number of people and the intensity of usage of things are used up in a city. I think that's maybe something I like to talk about, that pace of use, that speed of decay.
Do you take trips for inspiration? Are there parts of the city that you go to just to get inspiration for your work?
I go there on other business. I have to drop off a strip at a newspaper. I don't really get around enough just on errands. But I like this neighborhood in the low 30s, sort of between Broadway and Fifth Avenue. I like the remnants of the Garment District. It's a little further west. Those are sort of places I enjoy walking around. But,
what do you like about the old Garment District?
Well, there are some interesting places to eat in these areas because they serve businessmen of... There's sort of the last dairy restaurant is not far from there, the last dairy in Midtown. I like to see these remnants of light manufacturing in New York. There's still some assembly work done, some finishing, I guess, done in that neighborhood. Merchandise is still pushed around in the street.
One of the ways that cities are changing now, particularly Manhattan, is that neighborhoods that used to be one ethnic group are now another ethnic group. As more new immigrants move into Manhattan, and a neighborhood that might have once been Jewish might now be Dominican, or a neighborhood that might have once been one ethnic group might be Vietnamese now. Do you find that places with which you had certain associations or certain memories are becoming, in a way, very unfamiliar to you because there's a different culture that's taken it over that is very interesting but doesn't connect with your memories of childhood or even your memories of the city?
No, just the opposite. When I'm in a big Chinese cafeteria down in Chinatown, I feel exactly like I did when I was in a big Jewish dairy restaurant. It's the same feeling, this immigrant crowd handling food in a certain way, a certain urgency to the business, and it's actually, it completely transcends my, you know, ethnic background. And I don't, you know, I mainly frequent restaurants of other ethnic backgrounds because, and so I feel closer to those at the moment. And I think that interest very much transcends ethnicity. I mean, living in New York, it's so relative. I mean, to live in one, you know, ethnic world, you really have to, you know, go out of your way to avoid the world. I mean, that's one of the great things about a cosmopolitan life. You're not trapped by your own ethnicity. And no, I don't feel that at all. You know, once in a while I miss some Eastern European dish that, you know, it's not easy to find anymore in Manhattan. But, you know, there are a million other things. There are other cuisines that are sort of just as appealing to me. So, I'm not a big... No, that's easily substituted.
My guest is Ben Catcher, creator of the comic strip Julius Knipple, Real Estate Photographer. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ben Catcher. His new book of Julius Knipple comics is called The Beauty Supply District. When did you first get interested in comics?
I was a very small child before I could read them, basically. I saw them in candy stores, and I was attracted by the drawing, I think, and the color and the printing. Yeah, but it goes back to my earliest memories.
What were the first comics you drew?
Oh, they were, I don't know, little adventure stories about my cat. I had a cat called Snowball, and I think he had a TV show, I remember, in my comic strip. He was sort of the host of a TV show. That's something I can remember.
You went to art school, didn't you?
Yeah, I did study painting and drawing.
Did you ever think of becoming a painter?
Well, I was a painter. I did paint. So, I did. I did spend years in school painting and drawing. But I always had this sort of fascination with printing and mass reproduction. And it seemed like that was a more appealing way to have my drawings exist in the world.
Was that because they'd be seen by more people because they were mass-produced, or was there something about the process of mass production itself that you liked?
Well, I do like the process, but I like the idea that everyone could own an original printed image, take it home, read it, throw it away, you know. It's the nature of comics, newspaper comics, and I just like that.
When did you start to think about the possibility of comics for adults, comics that would not be about action or adventure or superheroes, but would be, you know, about urban life and about ideas and character?
Yeah, I think when I became an adult and I wanted this form to exist, that's when I began thinking about it. I mean, I always liked to have a story. When I was painting, I had a story behind my paintings. And I just felt it was unfortunate that the word and the image had become divorced, and there's a painting world and there's a writing world, and the two sort of never meet. They are, you know, the word and the image are just ends of the same spectrum, and they can meet. And I sort of knew that they could because I grew up reading comics. And so at some point, I began thinking about using my taste in image making and my taste in writing and somehow bringing them together in this form. This that interested me as a child. So that's basically how that happened.
Now, I want to ask you about a few references in your comics and see what they relate to, if there's anything specific they relate to. Okay, this is something you have in one of your comics. It's a public directory for the Alimentary Canal arranged in alphabetical order by family name. And it says, one could see at a glance the gastrointestinal condition of any person residing in the metropolitan area. So one page, it's kind of like a yellow pages of gastrointestinal disorders. Mm-hmm. So one page is labeled May 19th, 1957. Edis, W, gastritis, abdomen cramps, sluggish bowels, Eager, A, these are the people's names, Eager, A, diarrhea, irritable colon, rectal fissures. What inspired that?
Well, part of a city the thing that makes it allows a city to function are directories. People have to know where to find things. And the most common directory is the phone book, which gives us names, addresses, and phone numbers. And I just extrapolated that, and I said, well, wouldn't it be nice to be able to know the gastrointestinal condition of everyone in the phone book? For social purposes, for business purposes, there are, and that's what that came out of. I love to read phone books. I have a phone book from Chicago, from the 60s. It's one of my favorite books.
The Directory of the Alimentary Canal.
Hello, Mr. Eagle. I'm calling to discuss our... Oh, I'm sorry to hear that you're not feeling well. I understand. I'm sorry. I understand.
On the top shelf of a bookcase just behind Mr. Knipple's office desk, there sits a single, disused, and dust-covered edition of a once popular reference work, The Public Directory of the Alimentary Canal, in this case for the week of May 19th, 1957.
Ealing, William, 35 Pillar Avenue. Gastritis, abdominal cramps, sluggish bowels. Easton, Francis, 274 Acre, fecal impactment, diverticulitis, hemorrhoids. Eager, Adolf.
Upon its tissue-thin pages, arranged in alphabetical order by family name, one could see at a glance the gastrointestinal condition of any person residing in the metropolitan area.
Emmons, Cynthia, violent gas.
The directory's two-line summaries were more or less accurate.
Edison, Guy. Diarrhea, irritable colon.
It was culled from a multitude of reports filed each week by a vast, underpaid army of drugstore clerks, plumber's assistants, door-to-door canvassers, and public restroom informants.
Hey, buddy, how's it going in there? I had a big lunch, too. I've been here for 20 minutes. How about you?
Don't bother me.
You work in this building? I do, too. Sonny Biller. What's your name?
Leave me alone.
Hello, it's Martin Weimar calling from Babylonian Dogs to report sales from Monday the 7th to Saturday night. I have Suzanne Galudi, 92 Bark Avenue, who purchased a Jolita do-it-yourself enema kit and a package of hemorrhoidal suppositories. I have a Milton Eagle, who purchased two bottles of Fergitol laxative.
Freddy Catrolis, licensed plumber, calling with an activity report for last week. Right, on Monday, I cleared one obstructed toilet for Gary Jolson of 1892 Jefferson Boulevard. That same afternoon, we had a urinal overflow.
Shrewd businessmen and successful socialites
would not make a move without first consulting the latest edition.
But don't you know? The Nickleworths all have the runs this week. Says so right here. And you were counting on them. Perhaps we should reschedule the spring gala for next month.
Theater openings and restaurant profits hinged upon its authoritative word.
Look, 60 cases of intestinal flu on Roman Boulevard. If you open this week, you'll be playing to an empty house. And Arthur Elbor, the critic from the Evening Prong, has to have a polyp removed. It's no good. Bad timing.
All of this work, this wealth of information, this vast publishing enterprise soon came to naught when the directory ceased publication in the fall of 1958.
Hello, I'd like to speak to Mr. Bomas. Oh, can't come to the phone right now. Yes, I'll call back in 15 minutes.
That radio dramatization of the comic strip Julius Knipple, Real Estate Photographer, was produced by David Isay. Jerry Stiller was the voice of Knipple. We'll talk more with the creator of the strip, Ben Catcher, after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Ben Catcher, creator of the comic strip Julius Knipple, Real Estate Photographer. His new book of Julius Knipple comics is called The Beauty Supply District. I remember when I was a kid and on certain Saturdays I'd get taken against my will to, say, the linoleum store or the carpet store.
Right.
And the guy who worked there who'd be chewing this, like, already well-chewed cigar would have to fill out the carbon paper form in triplicate if they bought something. And you deal with stores like that. You deal even with, like, what happens to the carbon paper. I mean, who uses carbon paper anymore? But I wonder if you go through this, too, in the sense that there was, like, nothing I hated more than being in this store on a Saturday. But I'm fascinated by your version of that kind of store in your comic. So did you have that kind of aversion to this part of the world when you were young?
No, I remember. I mean, I probably wanted to be somewhere playing ball or, you know, looking through old comic books. I mean, I think even at the time I sort of appreciated the atmosphere of these places. I remember my memory of linoleum stores is a sign and all sorts of warnings, clippings from newspapers about children who were killed by falling rolls of linoleum in stores. And I remember there was this real sense of danger in these stores and the smell of that material. And the idea of patterns and decoration, it's sort of my earliest memories of decorative art are from going to linoleum stores. So, I mean, I think there was enough going on to fascinate me as a child. You know, whether I wanted to be back home with my comics is another question. But I did enjoy going shopping with my parents and sort of seeing these things. I preferred linoleum stores to clothing stores or toy stores to linoleum stores, but I liked, I think I did have some appreciation of what was going on at the time.
What kind of toy stores did you like? Did you like those cheap novelty kind of toy stores?
Yeah, I mean, my favorite toy store as a kid was a place called Bargain Town, which was in Brooklyn, on Broadway in Brooklyn, under an elevated train line. And it was a vast
kind of warehouse of discounted toys. And I mean, as a child, you could just get lost in this place. That was my favorite. I mean, there was a neighborhood toy store. I think children are immediately, I mean, by the age of 2 or 3, they're really, connoisseurs of merchandise. And they have taste in toys, you know. And they appreciate the qualities of toys. It begins at a really early age.
I want to close with another one of your comics that was dramatized for radio. This is called At the Door of the Candy Store. Would you tell us what inspired this one?
Yeah, that is directly inspired by my father, who... that's the one thing he did suffer from was heartburn. And I remember him trying to get a vanilla ice cream to assuage his heartburn. And I think there was a candy store, just like in the strip, that had just closed. And he had to beg the owner to open it and sell him an ice cream. So this is, it's a directly based on a memory of my father.
I want to tell you, I heard this one in the car with my father, and my father swore that he did the same thing.
Yeah, shows the commonality of heartburn, I guess.
Okay, well, let's hear this strip. And this was based on a comic by Ben Catcher, produced for radio by David Isay, originally broadcast on Weekend Edition Saturday on NPR. Ben Catcher, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
I have a terrible heartburn, and only a vanilla ice cream can save me.
These are the sales that are never made.
A cup, a cone, anything!
Grown men and women beg shamelessly before stores already closed for the night, convinced that the card hanging on the door had just been turned.
Do a favor, sell me an ice cream. I see you're in there to do business. Open the door!
They imagine a light still on in the back room where the owner is just now changing his shirt before climbing an inner staircase to his apartment.
Did I hide you to take my money?
Where, on the kitchen table, lies the latest edition of a Yiddish language communist weekly, still unread in its cheap brown paper wrapper.
I beg of you. I'm a sick man!
We heard Jerry Stiller as the voice of Julius Knipple. Ben Catcher was the narrator. Catcher has a new book of Julius Knipple comics called The Beauty Supply District. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Monique Nazareth, with Megan Howell and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Helen Wong. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, How the Heart Grows Wise on the Spiritual Path by Jack Kornfield. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with political reporter Wayne Barrett about his new investigative biography of Rudolph Giuliani. The mayor of New York City recently dropped out of the New York Senate race after being diagnosed with prostate cancer. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.